Thank you so much. My name is Ryan Britt, and this is my co-host, Lena Valencia. Lena. We started the Hi-Fi reading series in 2013?
2014.
Whatever. 2014. Seems like 2013 we started it. The premise, if you haven't been before, of the Hi-Fi reading series is Lena and I all will sit here and read work that we've written today for about 5 hours, and you guys can't leave. No, the premise of the Hi-Fi reading series is that we like to think that really great writers and organizations have great taste in finding writers that maybe are up and coming that you haven't heard of yet. So we thought we'd curate each month an established writer or organization, and then that person and or entity would bring amazing emerging writers to you. This tonight, I feel like, is sort of the dream scenario for the Hi-Fi reading series, because it's the kind of exactly the kind of organization that we like to showcase. And so we're really excited to have Minorities in Publishing curating this event. And to talk a little bit about that, I'm going to hand it over to the heart and soul of the Hi-Fi reading series, Lena Valencia.
Thanks, Ryan. Round of applause for Ryan Britt, because he's working hard. Okay, so I am so excited to have Jen Baker here with us tonight, / the Minorities in Publishing podcast. A little bit about the podcast. It is a twice monthly podcast that discusses diversity or lack thereof in the publishing industry and literary scene. Each episode features an interview with a writer or publishing professional who is not of the majority. And one of the great things about Jen's podcast is that the focus is as much on her guests' professional work as it is on their creative work. And the reason I think that's important is because one of the reasons that we still have such a lack of diverse voices in literature is not because there's a lack of diverse writers, but because of a lack of diversity in publishing and in the industry itself. So what Jen's doing with her podcast is giving these professionals space and giving them a platform to talk about their professional lives and what they do, and that's actually really important. So if you haven't already, I want to encourage everyone to subscribe to the podcast. Jen Baker herself is a publishing professional, writer, and baker. She's also a great supporter of this reading series. And she's curated an awesome lineup for you tonight. So please give a big round of applause for Jen Baker, tonight's guest curator. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. If you didn't get a cupcake, they're in the corner right here. Important announcement. Did you get a cupcake? Because if not, I have my priorities in check. So thank you so much, Lena and Ryan, for having me over here. I'm a great admirer of the Hi-Fi reading series, and I cannot emphasize how much I adore everyone on this roster today. Some I've known for a long time, some I've just met, but I have the utmost respect for them as writers, as people, as activists. So I hope you're as blown away by their writing and what they bring to the stage as I am, just in being in their presence every day, or Twitter or social media. So their energy is amazing, and I really hope you just adore every word that they say, because it was so much fun to compile this list, and everyone was a first choice. It was like, no brainer. And thankfully, they all said yes, so yay. So the first person up is Glendalise Camacho. She's like, you'll figure it. She is a Pushcart Prize nominee, a 2015 Write-A-House finalist, and currently a recipient of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council Workspace Residency. She has been an artist in residence at Gentel, Caldera, Kimmel Harding Nelson, and Hedgebrook. She also does online seminars on artist residency statements. So do find her at Glendalise on Twitter, because she'll be talking about that. So she'll be having another one soon, I hope. She is a proud Vona Voices alum. Her work appears in The Female Complaint, mine too. which came out on Sunday from Shade Mountain Press. Her work has also been in Soulmate 101, Other Essays on Love and Sex, Full Grown People, and All About Skin, Short Fiction by Women of Color from University of Wisconsin Press, as well as The Butter, Saraba Magazine, and Quelly Journal, among others. She's working on a short story collection and novel, and she's an amazing essayist as well. And I adore her more than life. So welcome, Glendalise.
Thank you, Jen. So I actually brought the book that like Jen and I are in because I was like, oh, I should read something from it. But it's called The Female Complaint, Tales of Unruly Women. And it's a great book, but I felt like reading something a little more, okay, a little less complainy and maybe like more. So I'm going to ask a question, which is an interesting one because nobody jumps to really answer it, but did anybody watch like pro wrestling when they were a kid? Yeah. Okay. Thank you, God. All right. So does anybody still watch it? That's the one that nobody likes to admit, but then people will come up to me afterwards and tell me like stuff. So it's okay. So I'm a huge wrestling fan. I'm actually writing a musical right now about pro wrestling, because of course, right? So I'm going to read an essay that's coming out like around Thanksgiving. The book's called Working Stiff, and it's an anthology, and this is the essay that I contributed to it. It's called Load Up the Spaceship with the Rocket Fuel. The first time I watched an Ultimate Warrior promo as an adult, I thought, how the fuck did this speak to me as a kid? I would venture to say Warrior was my favorite wrestler as a 10-year-old girl. He's certainly the one that towers over anyone else in my memory, but I would stop short of calling myself a true fan. I was casual in my devotion, like someone who shows up for mass every Sunday, but doesn't quite remember every parable. I watched WWF All-American Wrestling on Sunday mornings with the same regularity as DuckTales after school. A little strange, considering I was not athletically inclined, nor interested in being so. I was interested in the books I buried my face all weekend, not the park. I can't remember a skinned knee or getting dirty from play. Physicality was anecdotal in my family. Fighting was relegated to people who existed in the fringes of family lore. The grandaunt who once beat up a fruit seller, my father's father who was a major in the Dominican Army and died in a bar fight. By and large, I came from bookish, humble people. My grandmother had beautiful handwriting. My grandfather was a civil engineer for a sugar refinery and liked to solve math problems for fun. My father's master's degree is in museum studies. I followed suit as a quiet, obedient child, as are many children who choose to slip away to another world through the imagination. It would have made so much more sense if I, the consummate good girl, would have cheered for Hulk Hogan with his all-American image. Bret Hart's technical skills should have won over the equally proficient student in me. Even Randy Savage would have made more sense. His style was familiar. I grew up against the backdrop of late 80s Dominican aesthetic in New York, where louder, brighter, and shinier were better. But Ultimate Warrior, he was more raw than wholesome, more brute force than deafness, more frenetic energy than pomp. His theme song was a din of smashing cymbals. His signature moves included a gorilla press, which involved essentially hoisting a man above his head and dropping him unceremoniously onto the mat. And Warrior's ring entrance was nothing short of maniacal. A 275-pound man with a bodybuilder's physique tearing through the arena to the ring, the ropes of which he shook as if in the grip of an electrocution. My soft spot for pro wrestling must be an extension of the fondness I have for other symbols of pre-adolescence. Cherry frio frios on sweltering August days, Aquanet hairspray, Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. I never went to a live wrestling show, never asked my grandmother to buy me an Ultimate Warrior action figure. So how could I have been a fan of a man who shouted into a camera and threatened his opponent with, "Laughter is not the key for the disease that you have to contend with"? How did I hear him snarling whole strings of unintelligible sentences and say, "Yes, this resonates with me"? Clearly, the adrenaline of it all had made me deaf. It did not, however, make me blind. And that is how wrestling spoke to me, through the eyes. And what I saw in The Ultimate Warrior was future me. Not physically, of course, but in the fighting spirit I would have to adopt to be a writer. In the obstacles from self-doubt to rejection to systematic guardians of literature, lined up like opponents that fill the trajectory of a career. In the way you have to believe in yourself, beyond logic, almost delusionally, to pursue an art you love. Not with casual devotion, but with the fervor of fanaticism. Sometime in the mid-90s, I abandoned the WWF. After years of loathing Rick Rude and his arrogant gyrating, anticipating each time Damien would slither out of Jake the Snake's bag and The Undertaker hushing me into silence, I suspect the timing coincided with real boys being more accessible than the men on TV, but I didn't leave the wrestlers completely bereft. I tagged in a partner, someone fresh and full of enough energy to carry the mantle into a new era, my grandmother. Maria Mercedes Gomez was born January 3rd, 1929, billed from Puerto Plata, a northern coastal city in the Dominican Republic, but also from La Romana and the capital of Santo Domingo. She was trained in the sport of life by being the second youngest girl out of six siblings, six illegitimate children out of the nine her father sired but never fathered. She would later perform her matriarchal duties as Mercedes Camacho, accompanied by her husband, Francisco. Her U.S. debut was in Chicago. She eventually retired in New York. I called her by her ring name, Mommy. Her signature moves included un tate quieta, which was something like a Ric Flair chop that I can tell you made me see stars a few times. The promos she cut in the kitchen as she cooked, promising to wipe you off the map for your transgressions, were terrifying. But out of character, she was playful and self-sacrificing. Mommy had always been a sports fan. And yes, I know what Roland Barthes says in his essay, The World of Wrestling, that wrestling is not a sport, it is a spectacle. Wrestling is devoid of the unplanned outcomes at the heart of competitive sports today, but sports have their roots in spectacle. The very origin of the word sport is not in competition, but in pleasant pastime. It is a shortening of the word disport, meaning activity that offers amusement or relaxation. The national anthem, the crack of bats, Harry Carey leading the fans and singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game during the seventh inning stretch were as much a part of the spectacle the Chicago Cubs games my grandmother loved as the game itself. In New York, Mommy adopted the Yankees. After I grew up and moved out, I'd return home to watch the Super Bowl with her. Before her stroke, she looked further, internationally, waking up at 4 a.m. to watch World Cup games. There is a moment when you see your parents as people, when they break kayfabe. Parent is just this character they play. They had a whole other reality before you came along. And they contain a world inside of them now, parts of which don't include you. The revelation feels like treachery. All my life, Mommy had been Mommy, the person who woke me up for school, who reminded me to put my book bag where it belonged, who kissed me goodnight. She revolved around me like the sun around the earth, until one day my father corrected my geocentric view. As a young woman, Mommy had been a good swimmer. Forget the swimming for a moment. Mommy had been a young woman. Coarse black hair, no trace of grays, taut skin, robust body, laughing on a beach, racing against friends. Not just a good swimmer, my father said. She was a fish. Once she was in the water, no one could catch her. What surprised me then was not my grandmother watching wrestling, but her affinity for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Affinity is a light way of putting it. My grandmother loved Stone Cold with the ferocity Latina women her age reserved for the protagonist of a telenovela. She used to call me to remind me to bring orange juice for my daughter, who she babysat, to ask me how my recipe turned out, and to give me a play-by-play of how Steve Austin exacted revenge on Vince McMahon that week. One night, I committed the cardinal sin against any wrestling fan. I was watching Sunday Night Raw with Mommy sometime during Monday Night Wars. Vince and Stone Cold were fighting ringside. Vince turned around right into a crisp chair shot to the head from Austin. Mommy, you know this is fake, right? Rather than launch into the explanations that I do nowadays about the physical tolls on wrestlers' bodies, the danger being comparable to stunt work, or asking if I knew that my favorite novel was fake, my grandmother said, bring me that folding chair over there. Let me hit you with it, and you tell me how fake that feels. I never tested Mommy's belief in Steve Austin again. But how did a 68-year-old grandmother, avid knitter, in Easy Spirit sneakers, feel championed by a shaved head, blue-eyed, beer-chugging anti-hero from Texas? She certainly couldn't relate to Stone Cold as an immigrant or a woman. His being a personification of the Attitude Era, an era marked by great matches, rivalries, and factions, but also a generous dose of lowbrow jokes, racial stereotypes, sexual objectification of women, it should have seemed crass to someone like Mommy. Perhaps in Austin's antagonist, Mr. McMahon, Mommy saw a bit of her adversaries as a woman in Caribbean society in the 50s. The oligarchy, the patriarchy, cronyism. Her financially comfortable father, who sicked the police on his illegitimate children while sending the others to private school. The father of her two children, who threatened to bring every one of his army buddies into court. Every one. To dishonor her, to testify against her if she dared to take him for support. Strange as it sounds, I suspect Mommy saw her younger self in Stone Cold. When she dove into that water with the confidence he swaggered toward the ring with after that instantly recognizable sound of shattering glass. So much better than the competition, so good, all you could do was submit to their mastery and watch. Her shrinking as the distance from the shoreline grew, him growing larger as the audience swelled, until her limbs grew tired, until he retired. Two people who didn't need to be couth to win, who won because they weren't. It isn't necessary to remember every match, belt exchange, storyline, to remember the feeling. And the feeling is what matters. The feeling is what makes you a fan. And what did I feel watching The Ultimate Warrior? An air of invincibility that you could win or lose, but remain unbowed. That you were the first person who needed to be convinced of your worthiness as a champion, sometimes the only person. That this belief will propel you when your opponents win. Fighting was not anecdotal in my family. It was central, inescapable, necessary. Fighting was an opportunity to right wrongs, and if it didn't completely right them, it eased the helpless feeling at being at life's mercy. Even if you were taking the loss, you got a few good moves in. Stories are a way of slipping away from your life, but they're also a way of drawing closer to yourself. And the stories in those books that I read as a kid were no different than the stories I watched unfold in the ring. I shouldn't have been surprised by my grandmother's favorite wrestler, or mine. We don't always champion the characters who are a reflection of us as we are, as we want to be or are expected to be, but the ones we will have to become to continue our stories. Thank you.
Told you so. Next up is Ennis Smith. He and I went to grad school together years ago. And I remember when I first met Ennis, I said, he is so poised and he just has it together. I like that guy. And we've been friends ever since. And he's a fantastic writer to boot, so I adore him as well. He is a native of Cincinnati, Ohio. His work has been published in Creative Nonfiction Magazine, Ganymede, Mr. Beller's Neighborhood, and the nonfiction anthology Lost and Found, Stories from New York, from W.W. Norton. Other credits include Boys in the City and In Our Own Right, and he does dance and theater criticism in Attitude, the Dancers Magazine. He is a graduate of the New School's Graduate Creative Writing Program, and he is here to wow you, no pressure.
Oh, thanks. I'm going to kill you for that. I'd like to read an excerpt from a memoir in progress, and the only thing that you need to know is that it depicts the last night of a person's life. We encouraged his parents to go have dinner. It was after 6, and they'd been at the hospital all afternoon, performing their duties as next of kin, the work we'd been doing for the last year. Finally, they put on their coats, but not before Joyce began to fret, no doubt fearing her exit might be seen as a breach of maternal etiquette. "Are you sure it's okay?" she stammered. Her husband, Bill, told her that Dan would be fine before he led her out of the room. With them gone, the temperature shifted. A calm descended now that we no longer had to comfort them or second-guess our words. One by one, the friends who'd lingered in the corridor crowded his small room. His friend John broke the peace. "It's time," he said. "Time for what?" I thought. "Hurry up. Let's make a circle." Oh, no. He was talking about a prayer circle. I remember how Dan blanched when I explained this new backstage ritual, how before a show, actors and crew would gather and link hands while someone gave benediction, often to God, to foster goodwill for that night's performance. He would have hated it. But before I could protest, John had turned off the lights. In the sudden darkness, I felt someone take my hand to my left, and then my right, pulling me the wrong way, out of my hope into their resignation. When John called for a moment of silence, I thought how little sense it all made. The man on the bed was still breathing, still here. In this prayer by another name moment, I wondered how could they give up so easily? Where was their denial? Where was their hope? He and John had been friends but a few years. They were party, club, bar buddies who'd met in the East Village, and during all that carousing, cruisy nights, it seemed Dan had never brought up his aversion to religion or God. As pink winter light filled the room, I could make out the forms of his mostly new friends. Bodies stood close, hands linked, arms draped around shoulders in a collective embrace. I heard a sniffle, another. This sound spoke a truth. No one had sole claim, it said. Not me, not them, or especially his folks, cozened by now in a restaurant booth down the block. I would not be his parents in absentia. They'd rode into New York on a wave of entitlement by blood, but he'd been ours for as many years as he'd belonged to them. No, we were not the next of kin, but we'd seen him through the worst of his illness, which made us more than merely his friends. By the time his folks returned, many had already left. The rest took their arrival as a cue to say goodnight. And as hugs and handshakes passed around the room, people promised to call and insisted that Joyce and Bill ask if you need anything. Though Dan still breathed, his friends bestowed farewells more suited to awake. It was another sign I chose to ignore. Instead, I silently noted work schedules and phone numbers. I would call them all the next day to let them know he was still there and would want to see their faces, hear their voices, feel them stroke his brow. I knew that it was hard to watch. He was hard to watch. But for years now, they'd all been hard to watch. These friends of friends, our exes and coworkers and bosses, our running buddies and the men who'd cut our hair. Enough, said this goodnight. They wanted him to let go so they could leave these white rooms and waiting hours. But he wasn't ready, and neither was I. His parents settled into the only chairs in the room. Only Helen, our oldest friend, and I remained. Under spotlight fluorescence, the four of us stewed in winter wool, our pockets stuffed with tissues damp with inclement snot and intermittent tears. I hung by Dan's bed and listened to his crawling breath puncture small talk, mostly about the restaurant and their meal. And then he was up again. I got to him first, but we were all on our feet, startled by a sudden leap from stupor to agitation. I have to go. I have to go, he said, looking at us now as if we might doubt him. I sat on the bed. Where, Dan? I said. Tell me where you have to go. My aim had been to calm him and to avoid them dialing up his morphine. That faraway look in his eyes was gone. He was an embarrassed child, afraid to ask for another cookie. Pee. I smiled and looked at the others. This time, no visions called to him to fly from the room and out of our lives. His having to go meant he was very much alive. I reached under his bed for the urinal, ready to wave it like a flag. He wasn't going to die. His mother stood at the foot of the bed. No, Dan, stay. You have to go in your diaper. The next of kin was wielding her muscle in a way so unexpected we all momentarily froze. Suddenly, we were at an impasse, caught between the family's wishes, again, and our wish to please the man we loved. Dan broke it in an explosion that had been brewing perhaps as far back as the day he learned to walk. No, he keened, pulling so hard his father now had to help. Panic played across his sunken features, but in his eyes, always in the eyes, I saw a look from our early years, one usually accompanied by fuck after, say, a call from Joyce in Ohio. He'd sprang that look during venting conversations over whiskey and tokes of pot, or when he'd arrived back in New York after an obligatory visit they'd financed, perhaps because his mother sensed that otherwise he'd never set foot back in Cincinnati. My ex tossed and shook his head, his face a fist. But there was Joyce, no nonsense, insisting on a silly rule of law passed on by a nurse or a doctor who hadn't stopped to consider that despite the morphine and his wasting weakness, Dan wasn't ready to give up his dignity. As his father and I held him, I cursed the timing of it all. He was an only child, a prince with the power to say, take me as I am or don't take me at all. He'd never used it. But had he defied her earlier, would we have been in that hospital room? Or had AIDS, with his nothing left to lose prognosis, given him permission? Whatever the spark, this showdown between mother and son would turn on whether Dan would or would not pee in a diaper. Our acquiescence had become a tick. We, too, had done nothing but defer, not only to Joyce and Bill's wishes, but their passive-aggressive critique of our politics, our career choices, and most wounding of all, the way we'd handled his care. All that we could take. This was something else. She was punishing him publicly for getting the disease, for risking the ruin of their reputation, but most of all, for being who he was. What was it she said when he broke the news of his HIV? Oh, yeah. How could you do this to us? This was what she was going to do to him. Make him pee in his diaper in front of his oldest friends, two 30-somethings prematurely aged by all our sad events. If, as everyone but me believed, that that night was his last on earth, then Joyce had chosen this as her final act of love. Please, can't he at least just try? It was Helen, forceful, but on the edge of tears. The nurse said he had to go in his diaper. They'll clean him up when he's done, said Joyce. She had tried for a reassuring tone, but for a woman used to getting her way, Helen's question clearly threw her off. Now I spoke. Here, I'll help him. What would it hurt to let him try? Thank you.
Keep it going for Enos. That was, oh wow, that was fantastic. We're going to take a break now. We're going to take a brief break. So grab yourself a drink and come back for your next two readers. Thank you guys so much. Okay, guys, thanks so much for coming out. We're really, really, really happy with this turnout. I'm like totally thrilled. I was talking to a friend of mine a second ago, and like we were like on the verge of tears with that last one. Like, this series blows my mind, like how much talent that we get. So thanks for being here. Turn it over to Jen.
Yeah.
Jen, you want to give us the rest of your lineup? Give a hand for Jen Baker.
Quick food PSA, there's still cupcakes. I'm not taking them home. So, America's about consumption, so do your thing. So I think this is going pretty well so far.
Yes. Yes, it is.
That makes me very happy. So next on the lineup is Courtney Gillette. You always have that person like, yeah, that's my girl. And her energy is amazing. Sometimes I just want to stand next to her and just like, I just need to recharge because she's a burst of sunshine, literally, figuratively.
It's
Yeah. And I adore her work and writing and her as a person. She is an essayist and reviewer. She's reviewing books for Lambda Literary since 2010. She will actually be at Book Riot Live this weekend. She is going to be on the Rainbow panel on Saturday with Alexander Chi, right? And many wonderful people. So if you're going to Book Riot Live this weekend, actually, Courtney and Daniel will be there. She helps behind the scenes at BinderCon, which is also this weekend in New York City. She has served as a judge for the Lambda Literary Awards. In 2013, her work was chosen by A.M. Holmes for the Master's Review and nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She lives in Brooklyn with one bookseller and three cats. And she is also she is also the co-curator of another reading series called The Hustle. And that's going to happen at Word Bookstore in Brooklyn next Sunday at 2 p.m. It starts. And Daniel was also on that reading series, as was I, so they're donuts. Welcome, Courtney.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much to Hi-Fi, and thanks, Jen, and all the other readers. This is really cool. So this is a newer essay that I've been working on, and it's based on 2 years ago, Cosmopolitan.com did a feature that was 28 lesbian sex positions, and it was big because they'd never done that before. Like, they'd just discovered lesbians, like, in 2013. And it was, so, you know, it was a big deal, but it also it was not the best list of sex positions we'd ever seen. So it got me thinking about how fun it would be to write my own list. So this is that list. It is, I was thinking about this on the way over, it is 80% PG-13 and like 20% R-rated, maybe more than R-rated. So just, you're aware, we're friends now, you know. So this is three lesbian sex positions I have known. One, have your partner be your first. Every girl needs a first. Meet at an Ani DiFranco concert like the giant cliche it is. Kiss for the first time in a sea of queers, the air smoky, the lighting soft. Have your partner's name be a voluptuous mouthful of Italian-American femininity that belongs to a punk butch girl from Wilkes-Barre. Valentina Padovano. It's not her real name. Write it 50,000 times in your diary. Make out with the way those eight syllables taste in your young mouth. Have your partner be a freshman at Temple University. Tell her that you're also in school, which is true, except that it's high school and it's a town 40 miles from Philly. Talk to her on the phone every day. Meet her in the city for one date, two dates. Walk around Tower Records, get pizza. Confess that you're in high school. Have your partner choke on her cherry Coke. Ask if she'll show you her dorm room anyway. Watch her smirk hard as she swivels on the vinyl stool in that pizza shop to press her leg against yours. Run, walk the 15 blocks to the Temple dorms. Have your partner take off her shirt first. Bend your mouth to the warmth of her bare skin by pure instinct. Hurry out of your shirt, your jeans, your glasses on the floor beside the low bed, the only light, a harsh fluorescent street lamp through the cheap curtains. Touch as much as you can in the quick 35 minutes before you have to catch a commuter train back home in time for your National Honor Society meeting. Have your partner insist on walking you to the train station, hand wound in yours, and kiss you deeply on the platform among all the businessmen and suburbanites. Call her the next day. Leave a message. Call her the day after that. Call her all during winter break until one day her roommate picks up and tells you that Valentina Padovano dropped out. Wonder what happened to her. 15 years later, wonder what happened to her. Two. Have your partner be a stranger. Write back when she responds to your Craigslist personal ad on the Women for Women page in 2002. Email each other for 3 months, no photos. You're a 19-year-old NYU student and aspiring writer. She's a Romanian athlete on a diving scholarship in Boston. True. Meet for the first time in Grand Central Station one cloudy spring day. Drink together and sleep together and tumble into a long-distance relationship. Take the Chinatown bus back and forth once a week. Learn everything about one another's bodies. Make up the lesbian sex education neither of you ever received. Write long letters filled with hope and longing and the high of young love. Have your partner lean back in the twin bed in your crappy apartment and watch while you take off your underwear. Swear on your life that this girl is the one for you. Bring her home for Christmas. Your mother will yell that if you're not married, you can't share a bed, and you will yell that gay people can't get married in this stupid country, and still you'll have to sleep on the couch. Sneak up to your bedroom to hold that girl tightly against your body in the bed that once belonged to your lonely teenage self. Have your partner invite you to one of her diving matches. Watch from the bleachers as amateur after amateur hits the water before your partner climbs the ladder, raises her arms, and dives. The water slices so clean it barely makes a sound. In her room, climb on her lap and kiss her so hard that she picks you up, walks to her desk, and shoves all the papers and books to the ground so she can fuck you there. Offer to pay the fee at the end of the semester when she notices the scuff marks the desk made against the wall. True. publish your first ever short story about how much you love this girl. Keep taking the Chinatown bus. Spend some weekends fighting. Spend some weekends knowing she's away for a diving match. Have your partner call you crazy when you worry that she missed her flight home because she's sleeping with somebody else. Don't be surprised when she calls crying a week later to say that actually you aren't crazy. Have your partner mail you your things in the saddest box you've ever received. Publish your second short story about a cheating, lying diver and send her a copy. Attach a note that says, "Do not fuck with a writer." I really did that. I was so crazy when I was 19. Yeah. True. Three. Have your partner order Seamless while you scoop the cat litter before taking out the trash. In your 20s, you have sex. In your 30s, you talk about having sex. End up here in a long-term relationship, a healthy miracle, a shared address. Go 1 week, 2 weeks, 5 weeks without sex. Worry that this is the lesbian deathbed that you were warned of. Talk about it. Talk about having sex. Come home from work so tired that when you finally get to bed, you put your head upon your partner's bare knee and whine, "Does this count?" Have your partner suggest that you have sex on Saturday. Wind yourself into a knot of anxiety so that Saturday night the idea of sex exhausts you. Promise your partner that you want her. Have her promise back that she wants you too. Massage the nostalgia of how much sex you had when you first met. Bed shaking, skip dinner, over and over sex. Reach for the nostalgia of how much sex you had when you were single. The fucking irony. Go to the beach with some friends. Have your partner rub sunscreen on your back and wish that it felt like flirting. Watch the young queers who are topless and beautiful and envy their bravado. Drive back home. Find so much sand in your swimsuit and your jean shorts that you should probably take a shower. Have your partner say that they should probably take a shower too. Get in the shower together in your swimsuits because it's practical. Laugh about how much sand there is. Squint when you wash your hair. Chat about summer, about maybe going out to dinner later, about how the lavender shower gel is almost empty. Have your partner hug you when you're both naked and the water is warm and the sand has washed down the drain. Keep hugging. Inhale deeply. Have your partner sigh. Press your mouth against her neck. Try not to worry. See what happens next. Thank you.
I noticed I got super attentive when she said, so sex positions, woo! Fuck the game, sex. So, I mean, what I have to say about the next reader is he has been kicking ass and taking names this whole year. Daniel Jose Older, holy crap. So, I'll be brief. So I was following Daniel, as thousands and thousands of people do on Twitter. I said, wow, truth bomb. Yep, truth bomb. Yep, mic drop. Heard that. Yep, preach, preach. And I said, oh, I would love to have him on this podcast. And Glendalise happened to know Daniel. And I said, is it possible for you to do an intro? And I kind of said, even though it was an email, that's kind of how I was saying it in my head. Like, can you do an intro, please? And he was super kind to say, yeah, I'd love to have this conversation. This is an important conversation. And he's been having this conversation even before I started my podcast and for years. So Daniel is one of the most generous people you will ever meet. He is a fantastic mentor to teenagers, especially marginalized voices. He is there when you need him. He is so honest and embracing of what you have to say. And he is very truthful to the point that it can hurt, but I think it's the necessary truth we need to be hearing right now. And then add to that, he's a kick-ass writer, right? So, holy crap. So, this book right here was a finalist for the Kirkus Book Prize this year. This book right here was named one of the best books of 2015 by Publishers Weekly last week. This book right here has been something that numerous people have been saying we needed this book in the YA universe for a long time, with an Afro-Latina protagonist. So we have copies. He's going to read from it, I think. And I'm now going to read his long-ass bio. Well, I will say that he also has an amazing book, The Half-Resurrection Blues, part of the Bone Street Rumba Urban Fantasy Series, with an imprint from Penguin Random House that came out in January. And Midnight Taxi Tango is coming out in January of next year. And you probably have seen his work in BuzzFeed, The Guardian, Huffington Post. And he was the co-editor of the anthology Long Hidden, Speculative Fiction from the Margins of History. And if you do not follow Daniel on Twitter, his handle is DJ Older, and you'll just get those truth bombs I was talking about. So yet another person I adore, and I'm so glad I got to meet him. Daniel Jose Older.
That was really sweet. Well, shit. I don't what the fuck am I supposed to say now? Now I have to be nice to people. This is fucked up. I didn't expect that. Yeah, hi everybody. That's a really great crowd. You've been amazing so far. These people are amazing readers. Where's Enos? Yeah. Yes, give it up. Give it up for the readers. That shit was amazing. For someone to come up here and like talk about sexual anxiety and everyone laughs and it's a good thing. I just feel like literature is magic. That's so cool to me. I just love that. Who's a writer? How many people here are writers? Put your motherfucking hands in there. Dallas, put your hand up, motherfucker. All right, yeah. There's probably more. Who writes but doesn't consider themselves a writer? All right. Cut that shit out. If you write, you're a writer. Deal with it. I just say that to say that it's, you know, like really today and especially all week, but really all year and all this stuff that's been happening in the writing world, I just want to say that it's an exciting time to be a writer. And in the words of the Goonies, this is our time. And we should act like it. You know, like this isn't the Beats and this isn't the Renaissance, the Harlem Renaissance, but this is like us. This is what we're doing right now. And it doesn't have to be like any of the other times. And we don't have to walk in anybody's footsteps. We get to make the road by walking. We should do that and enjoy it as much as possible, because people will try to keep us from enjoying it. when we tell our difficult truths. So I just want to say embrace that. People ask me often, because I write for adults and I write for teenagers, like, what's the difference in how I write? And I often say that in the adult side, the characters get to have more oral sex. That turns out not to be true. I don't know if you've read any YA recently, but they have a lot of sex in YA. It's just weird. So I can't say that anymore. And they curse a lot. Like, when I wrote Shadow Shaper, I hadn't read a lot of YA, and when I first started it, and I was reading like Harry Potter, which it turns out is kind of middle grade and like, you know, goofy. And I love Harry Potter. So, you know, like, there's no swears in it. That was the hardest part of writing it, was like not swearing. And then, you know, it turns out that you can swear in YA, and I was like, fuck this. So I'll do a version where I swear a lot. No, I'm kidding. But I will do it when I'm going to recap, because I'm going to start from chapter 21. Oh, but first, okay, we're going to do a little interactive thing real quick, and then I promise I'll read. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. Okay, when I raise my hand, that's when you go, ooh. Okay, let's try it. Oh, that was good. Listen, I did it with a room full of librarians the other day. Sorry, they couldn't sing at all. It was terrible. I love librarians. Are you a librarian? Yes. I hope you can sing, because the rest of your people are in trouble. It was awful. But you guys are good. That was good. So when I raise my hand, you go, ooh, but prettier than me. Okay? All right. So where I'll catch you up real quick. Fucking Sierra Santiago is a 16-year-old muralist in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. She finds out that she's connected to a whole legacy of spirit workers that are called shadow shapers that bring their artwork to life by putting spirits into them. So they're the conduit between the spirit world and the art, usually paintings and stuff like that. But there's different kind of shadow shapers that do different things. It turns out that her grandfather, who's had a stroke and can't really talk that well, was like the head dude in this whole kind of brotherhood of shadow shapers, literally a brotherhood, because as it turns out, the reason she never knew about it was because she's a girl and he didn't want to tell any of the girls about this legacy. So she finds out about it, and it turns out that because it's an urban fantasy novel, someone is trying to kill all the shadow shapers. If that's not happening in the plot, it's not urban fantasy. There are no were pigeons or werewolves or were squirrels, but someone is trying to kill all the blank blank, which in this case is the shadow shapers. It works. Kirkus liked it. thank God, right? Shit. So there turns out that there's also this hot Haitian sensation dude with paintings all over him and tats, and he was a shadow shaper too. He is a shadow shaper. And Sierra thinks he's kind of cute, and he's a really good painter, and so they get kind of into this friendship, sexy friendship, where... she finds out that she's like, I want to be a shadow shaper. I'm ready. I want to learn. And he's like, well, I'm not that skilled. I can't make you a shadow shaper, but let me see something. And then they touch hands, which is sexy. And then no one has sex in this book. Like I said, I thought, anyway. And then it turns out she's already a shadow shaper. Someone mysteriously, without telling her, made her a shadow shaper. And she finds that out with Robbie. And so he's like, shit, let's go to Prospect Park, which is what you do when you find out you're a shadow shaper. You go to Prospect Park. And you start practicing combat shadow shaping, which is how to fight with the, you know. So he carries chalk around for that very purpose, and he shows her that you can do a chalk drawing, call on the spirits, and they'll show up. They're these big walking shadows, and then you raise your hand up in the air, and you touch the drawing, and the spirit goes through you into the thing. And so he's like, all right, now combat shaping. And he just runs off, and she's like, eh. And that's where we pick up the story after talking for 25 minutes. Chapter 21. Sierra swallowed a wave of panic and squinted at the dark trees around her. Oh, this dude just loves disappearing, she muttered, crouching. She placed the green chalk against the pavement, took a deep breath, and drew three sets of eyes. Then she looked up. The road was empty. Come on, spirits, I know you out there. She squinted, and for a few seconds, all she saw was the muted starshine of the night lanterns. Then three small, plump shadows emerged from the darkness and swayed toward her. There you go. She steadied her trembling hand, raised it to the air, and gulped as the figures launched into a run. The icy swirl poured through her. Sierra slapped her right hand against the eyes, and they sprang to life, each set swerving across the pavement into the night. Sierra smiled. Find Robbie, she whispered. All three pairs of eyes swung off the path into the forest. She rolled her own eyes. Really, dude? You just had to go right into the creepy forest, huh? She steeled herself and stepped into the woods. Sierra had never known such total darkness. She put her hands forward and moved quickly between the trees, trying to ignore her thundering heartbeat. A flash of green glinted across a tree stump a few feet ahead, and she made her way toward it. "I am seriously going to have a talk with Robbie when I find him," she growled, "seriously." When Sierra first heard the humming, it wasn't because it had just started then. It sounded as though it had been going on for a while. It was like when she'd be sitting in class for 45 minutes and finally get so bored she'd notice the stupid heater had been clacking and smashing away the whole time. The voices grew around her in a cloud of sound. Okay. Let's try that again. It sounded like the choir at Benny's church, both beautiful and haunting. That was better. The voices ranged from low and mournful to high and exultant. They blended together in rising and falling harmonies that filled the night. Sierra stopped walking and glanced to either side, but the forest darkness was unyielding. She wanted to yell out, "Who's there?" But that was too much like what the chicks in horror movies did right before they got ate. So she kept quiet and stayed perfectly still as the hum rose and fell in harmonious waves. It was too late to turn back. The noise was all around her, seemed to well up from inside of her. Okay, that was better. "Nice," Sierra said. "Got myself lured out into this stupid forest." She took a step back toward where she hoped the wide open field was. In the middle of this stupid, stupid situation, another step. The humming kept getting louder. After this stupid week full of stupid things happening, she couldn't take it anymore. The drone seemed to be covering her, bursting through her. Sierra ran. She didn't care about what she might run into or what direction she was going. All she wanted was to get away from that noise. But the sound kept with her, burned incessantly through her ears, trailed her like a stalker around every turn. Branches slapped against her face and arms, biting into her skin. She saw a log up ahead, planted 1 foot hard on the ground, and threw her body into the air. Young adult fiction. This is non-alcoholic, though, so it's officially, yeah. It was only after she landed, sailed over the log, and landed several feet past it that she realized something was different. First of all, she had seen the log lying there right across her path. It wasn't just her eyes adjusting to the darkness. She could see everything around her in crisp detail. And then there was the jump. She'd been airborne for 5 or 6 seconds easily. She had basically glided along until she felt ready to land. For a flickering moment, Sierra saw herself as if from above, bounding through the forest in long strides, nailing each leap. It was terrific and terrifying at the same time, like she was some kind of superhero. And then she was back without having lost a step. She hadn't escaped the voices. In fact, they were louder. And now she could make out dark shapes moving along the edge of her vision. She turned, her suddenly spectacular eyesight capturing every nook and nub of each tree, and she realized that there were indeed tall shadows rushing along on either side of her. They emitted a slight pulsing glow, a single illuminated heart beating through each one. A jolt of terror coursed from her throat into her stomach and sent tremors up and down her arms and legs. The humming, once a deep baritone, was becoming higher pitched. She bounced from rock to rock up a steep hill, grabbed a hanging branch, and hurled herself toward the top. Everything seemed to slow as she burst through the night air. The shadows flitted and swarmed around her, reaching out. Sierra saw a cement walking path ahead, aimed for it, and came down running. Something about these spirits buffered her, kept her afloat. She was protected. She could feel it all over her body, like the same faint glow the spirits emitted radiated from her, too. She shot forward, barely conscious of her feet moving at all. The path led to a clearing, and beyond that would be the long meadow and then Grand Army Plaza. She pumped harder. The trees became a blur on either side of her. Where was Robbie? As if in answer to her silent question, a pair of green eyes flashed past her along the tree trunks and then whizzed off toward the meadow. Sierra kept her course along the edge of the woods, the shadows swirling and dancing around her. He'd said combat shaping, and he would be ready for her wherever he was. She couldn't just roll out empty-handed or with a bunch of unformed shadows. Without losing stride, Sierra pulled out her chalk, now only a stub, and dragged it along the trees as she passed. When she'd tagged more than a dozen trunks, she doubled back. The spirits still storming along with her in long strides. She raised one arm and then retraced her steps, tapping each chalk mark as she passed. The shards of green burst to life as spirits danced through her. Now, Sierra thought, and she felt her small battalion of green projectiles fall into formation around her. Once again, the night seemed to hold its breath, a blessed moment of silence. Then Sierra pivoted off a stone and burst out into the woods. Shadows and green spikes unfurled around her like a crashing wave. She landed in an open field and raised her head just in time to see a splash of bright red flush across the dark grass toward her. Sierra leapt toward the nearest tree, caught a branch, and swung up onto it as Robbie's red tide passed. Where is he? The three pairs of eyes flew out into the field and converged at a darkened area at the far end of the park. Go, Sierra commanded her shards. She leapt out of her tree and hit the ground running, flashes of green flitting along at her side. Go! They burst ahead, racing across the field. Robbie's red tide swept out again, but this time Sierra was ready. She leapt up into the night sky, surrounded by the pulsing lights of the shadows, and landed far outside of the tide's reach. Whoa, Robbie yelled from his hiding place. Sierra smiled and dashed into a dark grove of trees as another red tide swept past. She crept through the underbrush, finished off her chalk on a nearby tree trunk, and shaped four more spirits into the jagged lines. Eyes, she called silently. The six eyes appeared on the ground before her. Lead the way. They sped off. Shards, when the eyes find him, strike. She walked briskly through the woods as the shards dashed ahead. But be gentle. Sierra strode out into the field toward the darkness, watching the bursts of light as her spirit soldiers converged on Robbie. Something red flashed, but then vanished. Ow! Robbie yelled. What happened? Sierra called. Ow! Call them off! Dang it, Sierra! You won! I get it! Back, Sierra thought. Fall back. Sorry, I'm still getting the hang of it. You give up? Yes, jeez! Robbie stumbled out of the darkness, his face smudged with green streaks. Where did you learn how to do all that? He was smiling in spite of himself. Sierra could tell it was one of those smiles that couldn't be held back or tempered. She shrugged. It just seemed natural, I guess. She wasn't really sure what had happened. Had all that flying through the air just been her excitement at being part of this magical new world? Or was something else at play? Either way, she felt amazing. Let's do it again. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh, that was like an emotional roller coaster of readings. Let's give it up for Glendalise, Ennis, Courtney, and Daniel. It was amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Jen Baker, for curating these incredible readers.
And that's our show. Good night. Have a drink. Thank you.